everyone. Welcome back to another episode of True Crime Cases. I am your host, Allison Mendes, and today we are diving back into the Lori Vallow and Chad Daybell case. Last week, we left off at the death of Charles Vallow, Lori's fourth husband. If you have not listened to part one, I would highly recommend going back and listening to that first. This is a really complex case, and I lay a lot of the groundwork for this case in that episode. And without further ado, let's just get right back into it. All right. So at this point in the timeline, we are introduced to a new player who is going to be Melanie Boudreau, not to be confused with Melanie Gibb. I will be using both women's last names from here on out when I'm speaking about either of them so that we can avoid any type of confusion. So Melanie Boudreau is Lori's niece, and she is very much invested into the same belief system that Lori has. So she is part of this group, this cult, whatever you want to call it. She's part of the Preparing a People group at this point in our timeline, which is June of 2019. So in June of 2019, Melanie Boudreau rather suddenly demands a divorce from her husband of 11 years, whose name is Brandon Boudreau. And we learn about this in a Facebook post from Brandon himself, where he says he believes that this sudden request for a divorce is due to Melanie's new religious beliefs now that she is in Lori and Chad's, quote, cult. The next month is when Charles Vallow is killed by Alex Cox. And at that point, no charges are pressed against Alex because he claimed self-defense, like we went over. Now, Alex Cox flies from Arizona to Columbia for 3 days after he shoots Charles on July 14th of 2019. And he returns on July 19th. Now, I'm not sure what he does in Columbia. I know they do extradite in Columbia, so I assume that wasn't the purpose of his visit, since that clearly wouldn't have worked either way. But I did want to mention it in case some information ends up coming out about the Columbia trip later on. I'm not sure if it will. I just found it really odd and really odd timing. So I've also heard that Alex had sent some payments, more than one, to someone in Colombia. And a theory floating around on Facebook that I saw and on Reddit, of course, said that they thought he was in Colombia possibly buying poison. And we'll get into the possibilities later as well. Shortly after Charles's death on July 20th, Lori also purchased a flight for Chad from Provo, Utah, to come to Arizona. Now, towards the end of July, from the 29th until the 31st, Lori and Alex are pictured together in Oceanside, California. Shortly after everything happens and Charles is killed, JJ, who is Lori and Charles's adopted son who has special needs, his service dog, her name is Bailey, is put up for sale by Lori. And this happens on August 9th of 2019. JJ had Bailey to obviously help him with his needs. Charles had bought Bailey specifically for JJ. And 3 weeks after he died, according to Ellen Killeran reporting for Crime Online, Lori listed Bailey for sale for $2,500. Now, this is very alarming for what I think are pretty obvious reasons. Your son is on the autism spectrum. He just lost his father, which I don't know if he witnessed it firsthand with his own eyes, but he was in the home or on the premises when his father was killed. And now on top of all of that trauma, you're selling his service dog which is obviously a massive part of his life and probably a really big source of comfort for him at this point. So that's just extremely cold to me. Now, before Lori could actually sell the dog, luckily one of the trainers from the kennel that they had purchased Bailey from happened to come across this ad, and he reaches out to Lori and tells her, hey, if you're getting rid of this dog, you're actually required to give her back to the rescue group that you purchased her from, which is where he works. So she does do this, and we know that Bailey is rehomed to another home with a special needs boy. Now, we do know that Kay, who was Charles Vallow's sister, and she is JJ's biological grandmother because one of her children actually had JJ and was unable to care for him, which is why Charles and Lori adopted him in the first place. So Kay does have a FaceTime call with JJ on August 10th. And it wasn't very long at all. It was less than a minute. It's not clear if she actually saw JJ on that call or spoke to him or what happened. But around that same time, Kay sends an email to law enforcement in Arizona requesting a wellness check for JJ. Now, Kay received Charles's $1 million life insurance policy payout. She, obviously, Charles had changed it from Lori, who was the beneficiary, to Kay before he was killed. And we don't think that Lori was aware of that. I think she had a suspicion because Melanie Gibb does an interview later where she says that Lori had a suspicion that he might have done that because she was going crazy and telling him crazy things. So I would do the same thing. But he did change it to Kay. And when Lori gets confirmation that she's not going to be receiving any sort of insurance payout for Charles, she stops corresponding with Kay. She won't respond to her texts or calls. And this makes Kay really worried for JJ. And this wellness check request would take a while. I'm not sure why. I don't know if people are getting the date that it was actually requested mixed up or what, but we'll come back to that wellness check. Now, on August 14th, Lori's iCloud shows screenshots of her purchasing two wedding bands. She purchased these wedding bands with Charles's credit card. And keep in mind, Chad is fully married to Tammy Daybell still. Nevertheless, Lori relocates her entire family from Arizona to Rexburg, Idaho, which is, of course, where Chad lives with his family. Not only does she moved to Rexburg, but she also tells her friend Melanie Gibb that originally the plan was actually for Chad to move to Arizona, but after some prayer, she realized she actually needed to be the one to move to Idaho. Now, she also tells Melanie Gibb that she, quote, had a feeling that Tammy Daybell, Chad's wife, would pass away before she actually got to Rexburg. Now, Tammy does not pass away before Lori moves to Rexburg, but she goes anyways. Ty Lee and JJ also move with Lori. I read initially that Ty Lee was actually going to stay in Arizona and move in with a friend, but the friend ended up saying later on that right before the move, Ty Lee decided to go because she felt like protective over her little brother JJ, and she didn't actually want to leave him. Which, hearing that, just kind of sets off those alarm bells a little bit. A 16-year-old girl should not feel like she has to protect her little brother. I get the feeling. I'm an older sister. I have a little brother. I'm very protective over him, but you should feel okay knowing that he's with your mom. So that's worrisome. And she obviously didn't have much faith in Lori keeping JJ safe. But regardless, Ty Lee, JJ, and Lori all move into a townhome complex in Rexburg, Idaho. So on September 3rd of 2019, Lori enrolled JJ in elementary school at Kennedy Elementary. Now, Ty Lee was only 16, but she does not get enrolled in school in Idaho, and that's because she had actually acquired her GED. And that also shed some light on why a 16-year-old would even have the option of considering staying in Arizona when her mother was planning on moving out of the state. That might seem odd to some people, but I went on homeschool my last 2 years of high school so that I could graduate high school. And I actually graduated when I was 16 and I moved out on my own that same year. So while that's out of the norm for a lot of people and for good reason, it's not absolutely unheard of. Now on September 8th, we know from photos and I believe Tylee's cell phone pings that JJ, Tylee, Lori, and Alex all went to Yellowstone National Park, which is only about an hour to an hour and a half drive away from Rexburg, Idaho, where they had just moved. And this would be the last time anyone would see proof of life for Tylee in pictures from this trip. On this same day, September 8th, Chad Daybell and his wife Tammy signed an application to increase Tammy's life insurance to the maximum amount offered by their insurance company, which I read was LifeMap. On September 9th, Chad sends Tammy a text telling her that he shot a raccoon and had buried it on their property. And I'll come back to this text because there's a little bit of a kind of explanation for that coming up. So on September 19th, Melanie Gibb and her boyfriend, David Warwick, visited Rexburg. And later in an interview, Melanie spoke about how Chad and Lori and her were all going on these walks at the BYU track together. And Chad and Lori were holding hands and kissing and just really clearly being outwardly physically affectionate towards one another. And at one point, Melanie Gibb said she actually asked, weren't there any concerns that Tammy, Chad's wife, might see them? And apparently Lori said something along the lines of, oh, Tammy doesn't come to this side of town. We're not worried about it. Melanie Gibb also said that Tylee wasn't brought up or mentioned at all during this visit. She obviously didn't see her. And she had been told by Lori that Tylee was attending BYU. Now, it's around this same time that Lori starts telling Melanie Gibb that JJ has turned into a zombie, which is another term for like what they call a dark spirit, just like Charles had, oddly enough, turned into right before he died. So this zombie behavior included throwing a statue of Jesus, saying he loved Satan, and additional communication skills slash verbal ability. I'm assuming maybe that means because JJ was autistic that maybe he was communicating oddly well for what, like maybe that was out of the norm. I'm not sure. And this is all coming straight from Melanie Gibb. So on September 22nd, Lori's iCloud shows a picture of JJ wearing red pajamas. And I believe this is the last photo of JJ that is taken. Around September 24th, I believe, is when Lori pulled JJ out of his new school, Kennedy Elementary, which is just about 3 weeks after he was initially enrolled in the first place. And that same day, Lori messages JJ's nanny and tells her that JJ's grandparents have picked him up and that he will be spending about a month with them, so she no longer needs the nanny's services for the time being. And also on the same day, Melanie Gibb and her boyfriend David Warwick end up leaving Rexburg and going back to Arizona. Just a few days later, on September 30th, Melanie Bedrell, Lori's niece, stops her pending divorce from her husband of 11 years, Brandon. And later on in the investigation, law enforcement would find information that insinuated that Melanie only stopped divorce proceedings after learning that she would not be able to collect Brandon's life insurance should something happen to him if a divorce had been pending at the time of his death. And I don't think that that's necessarily a law. I'm not positive. I think it was more she realized the kind of suspicion that might fall on her if her husband were to die and there's a divorce pending and then she gets his life insurance policy. I'm not sure. If you guys know, let me know. But wouldn't you know it, on October 2nd, literally 48 hours after Melanie Bedrell pauses the divorce proceedings, someone attempts to shoot and kill Brandon Bedrell. Now, luckily, this attempt on his life was unsuccessful. And later, Brandon wrote on his Facebook, on October 2nd, on my way home from the gym, someone sat outside my house and shot a gun at me. They hit my vehicle and missed my head by inches. He went on to write on his Facebook, my wife at this time, Melanie, began spending a lot of time with this group. At the end of June, she demanded a divorce, claiming revelation about things that were not real, and there was no evidence given, just a claim of being told by the Savior. Brandon identified the person who actually shot at him was driving a green Jeep Cherokee, which would end up being registered to the late Charles Vallow, and he actually recognized the shooter himself as Alex Cox. Now, I'm not sure what kind of follow-up was done on law enforcement's part, but I do know that after this incident, Brandon hires a private investigator to locate Alex and Melanie Boudreau. And Brandon, after this, goes into hiding along with his four children, who are very young, who he shares with Melanie. And we know this from, I think he posted about it on Facebook. Now, on October 9th, Tammy Daybell, Chad's current wife, calls 911 and tells the dispatcher that a masked man shot at her in her driveway with a paintball gun. She also takes to Facebook to post about the incident, and there she says that she has no idea who the shooter was or why someone would be shooting at her in the first place. Now, she thinks it's a paintball gun. What happened is, I think she sees the shooter pull the trigger and nothing happens. And so she, I'm assuming in her mind, was just, it was not a possibility that someone was shooting at her with a real gun. And so she assumed it was a paintball gun. But later, court documents would confirm that it was, of course, Alex Cox who attempted to shoot and kill Tammy. And obviously, it wasn't a paintball gun that he was using. Now, this same day, it is believed that Melanie Boudreau and Lori are together while Alex Cox attempts to murder Tammy Daybell. And there is proof that Lori had booked a flight the day before to fly to Phoenix, which is where Melanie Boudreau and Alex Cox were living at the time. So there's that. And just 10 days after this attempted shooting on October 19th of 2019, Tammy Daybell dies in her sleep at her home in Rexburg, Idaho, with Chad. She was just 49 years old at the time of her death, and Chad does not request an autopsy, so Tammy's death is ruled natural, and she is buried in Springville, Utah, on October 22nd, the following day. Now, the day after, her family held a memorial service for her back in Rexburg. On October 31st, both Melanie Boudreau and Alex Cox move from Arizona to Rexburg, and they both move into separate townhomes, but all in the same complex that Lori lives in. So Alex, Melanie, and Lori are all living within a few doors of each other, basically. Now, when Melanie is moving out of her house, the private investigator learns that she's leaving. All of the children's belongings are on the side of the road with a sign that says free, apparently. And remember, Brandon has gone into hiding, and for good reason. So with the kids, he's gone. And he said that he went so far as to have his PI plant GPS trackers on Melanie and Alex's vehicles, and they could see Melanie going to friends' houses looking for the children. Melanie also posted on Facebook offering a reward of $10,000, I believe, for information on where Brandon and the children were. And Brandon said it was highly concerning for him that she was so aggressively searching for him and the kids while simultaneously leaving their belongings on the side of the road instead of packing them in the U-Haul. This kind of indicates that she's not thinking clearly, or she's got some weird plans. So that's all I'll say about that. It's also concerning to me that she didn't involve law enforcement while she was looking for the kids. You hear about custody cases like this, and the parents usually involve law enforcement. Like, that could be a kidnapping charge on Brandon's part. Yet Melanie did not do that. And that makes me think that she didn't want law enforcement anywhere near her situation and she had things that she was definitely hiding. Now, thankfully, Melanie does not find Brandon or the children before her and Alex end up leaving for Rexburg, and they arrive there, I believe, on November 4th. And it's around this time a lot of people are starting to realize, okay, we're seeing a lot of adults and no children. Lori, Melanie Boudreau, Alex, they're all family. And Lori and Melanie have multiple children, and they're just simply not being seen with them, which is a red flag for sure. And this is where Kay Woodcock, JJ's grandmother and Charles Vallow's sister, reaches out to the Rexburg police now for a wellness check on JJ. Now, I couldn't find an exact date for this, but I do know that Melanie and Brandon do resume the divorce proceedings. And I want to say the date is October 22nd that their divorce is finalized, because I found the court documents for their case. And all it says for that date is that a decree was mailed out, and usually a divorce decree would be mailed out to both parties on the date that the divorce becomes official. And I could be wrong, but I do know that it's for sure in late October that their divorce is official. And I know that Melanie fails to appear in court at some point, so Brandon is granted full custody of all four children. Now, without wasting any time at all, Lori and Chad check in at the Kauai Beach Resort on November 3rd of 2019, and 2 days later, on November 5th, the two get married. Now, this is really fast, and in these pictures from the wedding ceremony, both Lori and Chad are wearing the wedding bands that Lori had ordered with Charles's credit card way back in August. And right around this time frame is when this case really starts catching law enforcement's attention. So on November 25th of 2019, the FBI in Phoenix and Houston are receiving multiple tips that Lori and Alex could possibly be involved in Charles's death, and that it's maybe a homicide. Now, remember, initially they were buying into the whole, or Arizona police were buying into the whole self-defense situation. And that's where we had left off in part one. But now people are sending information into law enforcement basically saying, hey, there's a lot of stuff that isn't adding up surrounding this group of people. And Charles's death is one of those things that's just a really big red flag. So November 26th, the Rexburg Police Department showed up on behalf of Kay and her husband, Larry Woodcock, JJ's grandparents, to conduct a welfare check like the grandparents had requested. At this point, police do not see JJ at the townhome, and Lori actually tells them that JJ is visiting with her friend Melanie Gibb back in Arizona. That same day, Chad reaches out to Melanie Gibb and basically says, he tells her that the Rexburg police are going to reach out to her to confirm that JJ is actually with her, which is obviously not true. So he tells her, hey, just don't answer the phone when they call. Just ignore it. And this should all just blow over. And Melanie pretty much does what she's told. The police reach out to her and try to call her, and she just doesn't pick up the phone. And without being able to get a hold of Melanie Gibb and still having no insight as to where JJ is, the Rexburg Police Department serves a search warrant to not just Lori's townhome, but also to Alex Cox's townhome. And when police search Lori's, they realize both her and Chad are gone, and that Alex was keeping quite a few firearms in his home. Now, I will say right here that at this point, Melanie Gibb sort of does a flip, and I think she's very upset when she realizes that Lori and Chad have kind of thrown her into this whole situation by saying that JJ is with her, which is obviously a lie. And I think that she starts to realize, hey, something's really off. If she didn't know it already, she now knows at least that law enforcement is involved, and that her name has been thrown in the ring. So she actually calls Lori and records the phone call. And Lori, the weirdest part about this phone call is that Lori knows that she's recording it. She actually says it. She says something along the lines of, I don't know if you're recording this phone call or what, but you're acting weird, which makes me feel like Melanie is being really fake on the phone call. And I think that she knows a lot more than she's letting on. But in her interview, Melanie Gibb mentions that Chad and Lori went on a trip to California with Chad's children, and it is believed that this trip was from November 28th until December 1st, when Lori and Chad stayed in a hotel in Southern California, which is when the police from Rexburg had served a search warrant on their home and they were gone. Now, while Chad and Lori are in California, both Alex and Melanie Boudreau get married in Vegas. Not to each other, obviously, their uncle and niece. But on November 29th, Alex Cox marries a woman named Zulema Pastenez at Chapel of Love in Las Vegas. The minister was later interviewed and said that he actually remembered the ceremony only because of the lack of emotion throughout the ceremony. The only witness was a security guard at the chapel. And another thing that stuck out to the minister is the fact that Alex decided to take Zulema's last name instead of, you know, the more traditional route, which is either hyphenating a name or the wife taking the husband's last name. Now, normally I wouldn't really read into something like that, but the timing of it all is incredibly sketchy. And for me, it's like they serve you a search warrant, you leave, 2 days later, you're flying out of state and marrying some woman who is, by the way, also a part of this group of preparing people or this religious belief system. And then you take her last name. And to me, that just looks like he is trying to shake law enforcement off his trail a little bit, but that's just my opinion. So Alex Cox is now Alex Pastenez. Now, the very next day on November 30th, and also in Las Vegas, after just 2 weeks of dating, Melanie Boudreau marries a man named Ian Pawlowski. And as I'm sure you've guessed by now, yes, Ian is also a part of the group and shares the same belief system that all of these other people do. So Melanie Boudreau is now Melanie Pawlowski. Meanwhile, Chad and Lori leave California and fly back to Kauai, Hawaii on December 1st. Now, at this point, the Kauai police get involved in the entire case, and they actually set up a live streaming camera outside of the condo that Lori and Chad were renting. But it would be almost a full month before they would actually catch a picture of Lori and Chad together with the camera. Now, I know this timeline is all over the place, and I hope I'm explaining it for you guys in a way that you're following, because I know it's bananas, but it just goes to show like how hard this group of people is trying to confuse law enforcement, because it is confusing. Now, by December 11th, the Fremont County Sheriff's Office back in Idaho actually determines that they are going to find Tammy Daybell's death suspicious, and they decide to actually exhume Tammy's body to perform an autopsy, since that was not done, and see exactly what caused her death. Now, it would take over a year to get the results of this autopsy, and they would not make the results public right away, but we'll get back into that in just a few minutes. Now, the day after Tammy's body is exhumed, and less than 2 weeks after getting married, Alex Cox, aka Alex Pastenez, dies at his wife Zulema's home in Arizona. His autopsy would reveal that he died of a blood clot. So basically, on December 12th, the Gilbert, Arizona Police Department were called to the home. Apparently, Zulema's stepson, I don't know if it's Alex's stepson and Zulema's son, but he was referred to in the article as stepson, was in his bedroom with headphones on, and Zulema was not home. She then called her stepson to check on Alex, and when he did, he found him lying on the floor of the bathroom, gasping for air and vomiting. The stepson proceeded to call 911, and first responders came and rushed Alex to the hospital, but at this time he was pronounced dead. Now, toxicology was done, as was an autopsy, and the medical examiner did determine that Alex died of natural causes. He said that he had blood clots wedged into the arteries of his lungs. Now, he also had high blood pressure, which the medical examiner said he thought did contribute to his death as well. When Zulema arrived at the hospital, she was questioned by police, at which point she asked them if she was a suspect in his death, which I think is a very weird question to ask if you don't know what caused someone's death, or if, you know, you're meeting the cops at the hospital. Obviously something medical happened. Zulema did tell police that Alex actually began having some shortness of breath on December 6th and that he drove to Mexico to buy some prescription medication because it was cheaper in Mexico, which that's sketchy. She said that when he got home, he had still felt winded, but that he was refusing to seek any medical treatment. Now, the day that Alex Cox died, he called Chad Daybell to receive a, quote, priesthood blessing, end quote, over the phone. I find that very odd. From what I've heard about Alex, he was sort of blindly loyal to his sister, Lori. He took care of all of the worst things that she wanted him to do, including murdering people. And he also fully believed in these ideas that Lori and Chad were these reincarnated people who were chosen by God to prepare the 144,000 for the second coming of Christ. So when I think to myself, you know, I wonder if Alex would take his own life if he was asked by someone that he respected and followed and looked up to, I don't think that's really very far off to think about. Now, here's why I want to address the Columbia trip, as well as the recent trip to Mexico that Alex had taken, and the theory that he could have been buying poison. Now, this is not proven. This is 100% just a theory. I want to say that. But I do think it's a possibility, maybe. I don't know a lot about poison, or like what kinds of poisons have what kinds of symptoms and what would show up on a normal toxicology report and what might not. I know that there are certain types that are not traceable in a normal toxicology report. You would have to be actually looking for those types of substances. But what I do know is that Tammy died in her sleep while being perfectly healthy, which is weird. And we know that Alex sort of dies of this crazy medical emergency right at the same time, and that he knew he was going to die because he called Chad to receive a blessing before he passed away. And we know that law enforcement is starting to investigate all of the dirty deeds this group of people has been up to. A lot of it leads back to Alex, because he's the one who carried out all of the dirty deeds for this group of people. So it's just my opinion, and it's just one of the many different theories I could dive into when it comes to this case, but I thought it was worth mentioning, so let me know what you guys think. So on December 14th of 2019, Ian Pawlowski contacted the FBI. He says that Chad and Lori had reached out to his wife, Melanie, who is Lori's niece, saying that two of Chad's children had been contacted by police and that they were threatened with their mother's body, Tammy Daybell, being exhumed. Ian says that Chad and Lori felt they were being treated unfairly by the Rexburg police and bullied, and they thought this threat was simply a sort of scare tactic. And what I gathered from this is that Ian was possibly calling to see if the actual FBI were involved in this case, because I know it had been mentioned, but Chad and Lori did not believe that the FBI were involved. And that's really all that happens on this call. But of course, Tammy's body has actually already been exhumed. So they're clearly not very up to date, because they're flying all over the place trying to avoid law enforcement. Now, on December 20th of 2019, the Rexburg Police Department finally announced JJ and Ty Lee as missing persons. The police do mention that their disappearance may be linked to what they refer to as the suspicious death of Tammy Daybell. And the next day, they actually officially name Chad and Lori as persons of interest. Now, Chad and Lori have their attorney put out a statement just 3 days later, stating that both Chad and Lori are loving and devoted parents, and that they will only address these allegations once they move beyond rumor and speculation. On January 3rd of 2020, local police, along with the FBI, serve a search warrant on Chad Daybell's home in Salem, Idaho, where they recover 43 items, which included computers, cell phones, journals, documents, and medication. And all of this evidence that's collected at the home is sent back to an FBI lab to be analyzed. Now, keep in mind, this entire month, both Chad and Lori are still in Hawaii. So on January 25th, the Kauai Police Department served Lori with a notice stating that she must produce both JJ and Ty Lee to the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare or to the Rexburg Police Department within 5 days. The next day, Nate Eaton and Eric Grossarth, they are reporters for East Idaho News, fly to Kauai to confront Chad and Lori. And the same day, law enforcement also seized the couple's rental car and searched their rental townhome that they had been staying in. And at this point, Chad and Lori are still refusing to speak to the press. They refuse to say where either of the children are. And on January 29th, Kay and Larry Woodcock, JJ's grandparents, go and file for guardianship of JJ, while simultaneously the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare is conducting an investigation into where the children are and their well-being. So everyone is really focused on the kids now. January 30th came and went, and Lori missed the 5 p.m. deadline that she had been given to produce the children. And Kay is really active. She's very much an advocate for JJ. She puts a lot of time and effort, and you can tell that she's just really, she loves him and she's very concerned. She holds a press conference when this deadline passes and JJ is still not presented, and she speaks out against Lori and states her disappointment in not knowing where her grandson is or if he is okay. Now, finally, on February 20th, the Kauai police arrest Lori on a $5 million warrant from Madison County, which is back in Idaho. At this point, Lori is charged with 2 felony counts of desertion and non-support of dependent children. She is also charged with arrest and seizures, resisting or obstructing officers, criminal solicitation to commit a crime and contempt of court, willful disobedience of court process or order. Just 6 days later, Lori waives her extradition to Idaho after she's been held in Hawaii in jail. And this waiver only comes after she has multiple failed attempts to lower her bail. And you hear later that Lori only waives this extradition because the conditions of the jail in Hawaii are significantly worse than that of the jails in Idaho. So on March 5th, Idaho authorities extradited Lori from Hawaii back to Rexburg. And the next day, Lori appears in court where her bail is lowered from $5 million down to $1 million. Even after her bail is lowered, she is still unable to make bail, so she's still being held behind bars. And keep in mind that Chad is still a free man at this point. He has not been arrested. Now, on May 1st, it's revealed that conversations between Lori and her lawyer have been unlawfully recorded by the jail. And when I looked into this, what really happened was that with COVID happening and all of the restrictions, instead of lawyers meeting with their clients in the usual capacity, face to face, you know, in a separate room, they instead were meeting like with the plexiglass between them, where they each pick up a phone and they communicate that way. And so their conversations were recorded through those means, but not purposefully. It was just a mistake, because if that had been a normal visitation, they wouldn't have, her lawyer and her would have been meeting in a room without the recording devices. But instead, they were just in a different area and the jail hadn't really completely converted and shut down the recordings and all of that. But regardless, Lori's lawyer uses this as a reason for lowering her bail even further, but the jail, or the judge, is just not buying it. And yet again, the request is denied. And her bail remains set at $1 million. Now, I believe it's May 26th that Melanie Gibb finally speaks out to the press, and she does an interview with East Idaho News's Nate Eaton, where she really breaks down a lot of information, a ton of the belief system that these people had, and just quite a bit of stuff that's behind the scenes that you wouldn't know unless someone directly involved with this group and these beliefs told you. And she really explains a lot of what it means to them. And I will link that full interview in the show notes for you guys if you want to watch it. I believe it's a little under 2 hours long. I think it's like an hour 45, but it's very interesting to watch. Now, on June 9th of 2020 at 7 a.m., the Rexburg Police Department, the FBI, and the Fremont County Sheriff's Office search a warrant for Chad's home and his property. Within just a few hours, investigators find unidentified human remains buried on Chad Daybell's property. And just a few days later, law enforcement does confirm that the remains belong to both JJ and Tylee. Now, JJ's remains were found, and he was still wearing the red pajamas that he had on in the last picture they found of him in Lori's iCloud. And Tylee's body was allegedly dismembered and severely burned. And now we're going to go back to that raccoon text, because the day that Chad Daybell sent his wife that raccoon text, it is believed that Tylee was killed before JJ. And I think that the kind of idea around this raccoon text that Chad sent to his wife, Tammy, who was still alive at that point, is that he said that he killed a raccoon on their property and buried it. I think the idea around that is that there was a fresh area where something had clearly been buried, and people think that that was Tylee's body, and that he was trying to throw any suspicion from Tammy by saying, hey, just so you know, if you see that fresh patch of dirt out there, like, I killed a raccoon today and I buried it on our property. So that's why that was the big idea around the raccoon text, basically. Now, by noon on June 9th, Chad is taken into custody after law enforcement finds the remains, and he is booked into the Fremont County Jail on 2 felony charges of concealment, distribution, or altercation of evidence. The next day, Chad makes his appearance in court via video conference, and the judge sets his bail at $1 million. Now, a lot of kind of court back and forth continues for a few months. But on February 4th of this year, 2021, the autopsy on Tammy Daybell was completed. And like I mentioned earlier, the findings were not released, but the Fremont County prosecuting attorney, Lindsay Black, I believe, does request that the Idaho attorney general send the case back to her office, which the attorney general does. And on May 24th of this year, a grand jury indicted Chad and Lori Daybell on several new felony charges, including first-degree murder, as well as conspiracy to commit murder. And the charges are announced publicly the next day, which is where we officially see that Tammy Daybell is one of the homicides that they are being charged with, meaning that her death was not natural. They are obviously being charged with JJ and Tylee's deaths as well. So on June 8th, Lori was committed to the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare, and she has been deemed by a psychologist as not fit for trial, which a judge agreed to. Now, she will be reevaluated after she's been committed for up to 90 days, and that deadline is coming up in the near future. So we should have an update on that pretty soon. As far as Chad goes, he is competent to stand trial. I don't think that was ever in question for him, but he pleaded not guilty to all charges on June 9th. Now, this month, we found out that the prosecutors in Idaho will in fact be seeking the death penalty against Chad Daybell in the killing of JJ and Tylee. We also found out that they are seeking the death penalty against Chad in the case of Tammy Daybell's death as well. This means that more than likely they will be seeking the death penalty against Lori. It's just a matter of when she will be found fit to stand trial. And that has yet to be decided. But for now, that wraps up part 2 of this insane case. Now, this is obviously ongoing and very active. And as we get more updates on this case, I will update you guys, whether it be an entire episode if it's quite a lot of information, or just small updates at the end of future episodes. But I will always be posting that on social media. So you guys can find this podcast on Instagram and Facebook at True Crime Cases Pod and on Twitter at TC Cases Pod. I love to interact with you guys on there. I would love to hear what cases you would like me to cover. I will cover a case if you guys suggest it to me. So just send me a message or comment on social media and let me know. As usual, thank you guys so much for tuning in. All of my sources will be linked in the show notes, and I hope you all enjoy your weekend and stay safe. I will be back next week with a brand new case. Thank you.